Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I am Lance Tauzer. Today I have the honor of speaking to a musical genius, Herbie Hancock. I am actually speaking to you inside the middle of the exhibit. We built a radio studio in the middle of the exhibit, and patrons are walking by the windows and listening to our conversation as we speak.
Okay. Hi there.
You're waving. And so the whole point of this exhibit was to, you know, make a case that the state of Illinois has produced great musicians over the years, and it's, you know, been a launching pad for some others that maybe weren't born in Illinois, but they made their career home. So my first question was, in what way did your upbringing here in Illinois impact your development as a musician?
It was a real foundation for me, because Chicago in particular is a real blues town.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly was back then. And at the time, when I was a kid, I wasn't a big blues fan. You know, that was maybe popular for older people, but not for younger people.
Mm-hmm.
But I did listen to rhythm and blues. And I was born in 1940. So in the 40s, or the early 40s, rhythm and blues was called race music.
Right.
And somewhere in the mid-40s, it changed to rhythm and blues. I haven't looked up the chronology, but I think I'm partially pretty close to being right anyway.
Yeah, they referred to them as race records.
Right, race records, right, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what it was, race records. So that was in my neighborhood. I lived in a black neighborhood. I mean, I don't remember any white people that lived there unless they were married to someone who was black, you know. And gospel music was also prevalent in the neighborhood too.
Sure.
So music was very strong in that neighborhood. First of all, it's a big city. Chicago's a big city, and so you know, it's not like being out in the suburban area or in more rural areas of Illinois, and there are plenty of those.
Sure.
So you could always hear music coming out of the windows in the summertime of your neighbors.
Yeah.
And so music was always in the air.
I was going to ask you, how did your family support your passion for music? You're described as a child prodigy, but what was that family dynamic like?
It's funny when I hear that, because I mean, I never refer to myself like that. I mean, I'm grateful that people kind of feel that way about me, but me looking at myself, I was just a piano player.
Right.
And I was pretty good at it.
Sure.
Anyway, my mother noticed, because I didn't get a piano until I was 7 years old. But when I was six, my best friend, who lived in another apartment in the building, his parents bought him a piano.
Mm.
And although I went over to his house, you know, quite often to his apartment, my mother noticed that I was going over there more often than before, and that I always asked immediately. I didn't say, "Hey, how you doing?" I would say, "Hey, LaFesta, can I play the piano?"
Mm.
She noticed that. Well, mm-hmm. I didn't know how to play the piano. I have no idea what I played. I'm sure he had to teach me chopsticks.
Sure.
Because I didn't know anything about it. You know? I didn't just walk over there and immediately start playing Mozart.
Believe
me. So because my mother noticed that I seemed to be interested in music, and basically the family was a more matriarchal family. My mother really was the kind of the foundation
for
the family, and my father was more like, yes, dear, or ask your mother.
Right.
Well, they were married they were married for the rest of their lives.
Mm.
And I found out that that's where you stay married.
Right.
Is you say, yes, dear, and ask your mother.
That's right.
Because I do the same thing, by the way.
I was going to say, I think you were married in 68?
Yes.
Is that right? And you're still married to Gigi, right?
Yep, still married to Gigi.
Congratulations. My goodness.
Hey, thanks. And it's worked because, you know, I defer to her. I mean, unless it's something that I really need to address personally, but
sure,
you know, I give her a lot of, because she's a very strong woman. My mother was a very strong woman.
All right.
Anyway, my mother told my father, we got to get this boy a piano, but she was happy that I seemed to be interested in music, in culture, you know. By the way, on my father's side of the family, most of my uncles, and there were a couple of aunts, but I had about, let's see, I had three uncles, mm-hmm. three or four uncles. Anyway, they seemed to be primarily interested in the visual arts.
Oh.
So they were sculptors and painters, you know. That was from the Hancock side of the family.
Right.
My father's brothers. And my father was, I could tell that he had artistic talent, mm-hmm. from visuals, but he was also good in math.
Ah.
Good in arithmetic. He actually didn't graduate from high school. He only went two years of high school when he was living in Georgia before he moved to Chicago. When he was a kid.
Yeah.
And he finally did get his high school diploma from the what's it, GED program? Is that what it's called?
Sure. Yep.
Yep. And he was so proud to get that.
That's nice.
Because he threw it across the table. He didn't tell my mother that he was taking those those classes. But when he got the official congratulations, you know, and
yeah,
he threw that letter across the table for my mother to look at and say, "There, I got mine."
Right.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, so my parents bought me a piano. I realize now it was a piano for the family.
Right.
But the occasion was my birthday, so it was my birthday present.
Sure, sure, sure. And do you remember how old you were at that when the piano?
Yeah, I was seven.
You were seven. Okay,
I was seven. And my older brother and my younger sister also started taking lessons with at the same time I did. We did all together about maybe a couple months after I got the piano.
All right.
So I got the piano in April, might have been June when I started taking piano lessons.
So you get the piano when you're seven, but by age 11, you get to play with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. How did that happen?
I know. That's strange, isn't it?
It is. Well, it's,
anyway,
you don't like the term child prodigy, but that usually doesn't happen.
That doesn't usually happen. No, it doesn't. But there was a series of concerts that the Chicago Symphony Orchestra used to give. It was a contest, actually, that they gave. and it was for a series of concerts called a Young People's Concert Series. And they would have auditions for each instrument of the orchestra, and they would select one person for each instrument to play one night with the Chicago Symphony to play the concerto that they used for the audition.
Yeah. Yours was Mozart. What was it? Oh, I had it written down here. Yeah, it was a Mozart concerto at age 11. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was the D major concerto.
That's right.
Another name for it. They had another name in English. But I've forgotten that one now. But I actually auditioned with a different one.
Oh, you did?
I auditioned with a B-flat concerto.
Oh, right.
And when I received them, this is interesting, and this is very timely now, that when I received the postcard that they sent announcing to me that I had won for the piano, they selected me for the piano, they said, unfortunately, we could not find the orchestral parts for the concerto that you use for your audition. And so you'll have to either learn a new concerto or forfeit.
Ooh. So you went now, with learn the new concerto for sure.
So what does that tell you?
That means
from back in 1952, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about right.
I probably got the letter in actually 50, the end of 51.
All right.
And, well, I had to learn a new concerto. That's when I learned the concerto in D major.
Gotcha.
Emperor Concerto it might have been.
By
the way.
Yes.
1 week after I played with the Chicago Symphony, my music teacher had gotten tickets for me to see Myra Hess, who was a very famous classical pianist at that time, because she was performing the following week.
Ah.
And so as a, you know, congratulatory prize, she bought these tickets for me to see. So I was happy to go there.
That's a
bonus. And of course to her. Right. Guess what she played?
What did she play?
The B-flat concerto.
Oh, did she? What you originally auditioned with?
Yeah. Oh. The one they said they couldn't find the...
Oh, they conveniently the found it, though.
They conveniently found it. My music teacher was livid. She was livid.
I'll bet.
Because, I mean, how could you do that to an 11-year-old kid?
Right.
You know? I mean, there's no way I could play it as well as Myra has, you know?
Well.
Forget about that. So what kind of excuse could they have made? You know, they had never actually, I don't know about the other instruments, but they had never picked a black kid to win that contest before.
Mm. They might have been messing with you.
Might have been messing with me. Yeah.
Right. So jumping ahead, at age 21, you were offered a chance to move to New York and join Donald Byrd's group. And this on the heels of this move, you score a record contract with Blue Note and you release an album called Taken Off, and you have a hit with the song Watermelon Man, all at the age of 21. I mean, what was this part of your life like? All of that all happening at once and again relocating to New York and everything.
Well, I was thrilled to be asked to be in Donald Byrd's band and to move to New York, because that in New York was the mecca for jazz.
Yeah.
And so I was delighted to be able to do that, and it was Donald Byrd also that made it possible for me to get a contract to do my first record.
Yeah.
And on that record, there was a piece I wrote that was inspired by my experience in Chicago.
Oh, yeah?
And it was called Watermelon Man.
The hit tune.
That was the hit tune, right?
Yeah.
And so my record did very well. It was on the charts.
Yes.
And then I had the opportunity to work with a Cuban percussionist named Mongo Santa Maria later on that year, and I was actually able to play Watermelon Man for him during a break that we had in a set that we were playing actually in the Bronx of New York. We were playing in a small club up in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started, thanks to Donald Byrd, it was Donald Byrd that told me, said, why don't you play Watermelon Man for Mongo?
Okay.
And I was wondering, what is he talking about? That was when we were taking a break.
Uh-huh.
And I said, it's a little funky jazz tune. What does that have to do with Latin music? Anyway, I started playing it. And Mongo said, keep playing it. And Mongo got on the conga drums, which is his instrument.
Right.
Started playing, and it just fit perfectly.
Wow.
And one by one, the band members started picking up on it and playing it. And people started getting on the dance floor, and people started screaming. They were saying, this is it, and they were wow, all dancing and having a ball. It was like in a movie.
Yeah, that sounds like something in a movie, something that happens that organically. Kind of gives you chills that he joins in, that guy joins in, and the crowd goes nuts. That you can't sort of write that the way it
right.
happened. Yeah,
right. And I saw that with my own two eyes. I was blown away. And so Mongo asked if I could record that. I said, you know, of course. Anyway, he did. His record became a huge hit.
Yeah.
That was a magazine called Cashbox.
Oh, yeah. That was a big chart magazine for a long time.
Right. And it was number 10. So it was in the top 10 for that one. And Billboard, I think it got, it wasn't in the top 10, but it was like 11 or 12,
hey,
somewhere in the teens.
Not too shabby. So the next story I was going to ask you about, so this exhibit also features another Illinois jazz artist, Miles Davis. In fact, his trumpet, I think it was from 1980s, was one of the last trumpets he ever had made for him, is sitting right next to your materials in our exhibit. And in 1963, you were given the chance to play in his quintet. Tell me, I mean, we're talking about Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, Tony Williams, some of these, you know, jazz greats. How did that come about, and how did that change your career moving forward?
Well, Miles actually called me, and he also called Tony Williams. He had recently hired, in the previous few months, maybe 2 or 3 months, kind of an interim band.
Mm.
And so we knew that he was, you know, searching to get new members in his band.
Yeah.
And then I had heard that Miles was asking about me. Asking a lot of people about me, and I didn't believe a word of it. But then one day he called, and so Tony Williams and I were the new people, whereas Ron Carter and George Coleman had been in that interim band that had played with Miles before, and so I was thrilled to be chosen to play in Miles's band, and let me tell you, I couldn't believe it when I could walk out on the street from Miles's house where we had been rehearsing,
mm-hmm.
walk down the street, hear through everybody in the summer, everybody's windows, everybody playing Watermelon Man, either the record or it was on the radio. I could hear that, and here I am with Miles Davis's band.
Wow.
And it was like, doesn't get better than that.
That's a little surreal to be right. Serenaded by New York while you're walking down the street. I mean, and you guys played a lot of or recorded a lot of the big classics, ESP, Nefertiti, Sorcerer. I mean, that was sort of a big period for Miles as well, and you were a big part of that. That must have helped your career sort of moving forward, wouldn't you think?
Oh yeah, I was thrilled playing with Miles, because Miles told us that he paid us to try things, explore new territory, you know. And I was that kind of person anyway. I was always looking around to see what new thing could I come up with, or how could I put this thing over here and this thing over there that don't seem to go together.
Right.
Together. How can I put them together? I've always been like that since I was a kid.
Yeah.
So Miles, I mean, that's what he stood for. He wanted innovation. And I was all over that. And I love technology, too. But, of course, it's different now than it was back, back then.
Well,
but when Miles pointed me toward an electric piano,
yes.
A Fender Rhodes piano, at first, I kind of rejected it in my mind, but because Miles asked me to play that on one of his records. It was Miles.
Yeah, sure.
So I plugged it, and he had one there, plugged it in, and I had been told that it was a toy, and most of the other musicians, you know, they really, like, bashed the reputation of the Fender Rhodes
right.
piano. And so I wasn't looking forward to playing it. But when I played a chord, I said, oh, this sounds pretty.
Yeah. The sweet sound.
Yeah. And I learned a huge lesson that I've carried with me the rest of my life from that experience. And that is, never form an opinion that's based off of somebody else's experience.
That's good advice.
Yeah. Check it out for yourself and see what you think, because that's the important thing.
Yeah.
And I've tried to do that, you know, throughout my life.
Yeah.
And it's serving well.
Well, you bring up technology. Your career, you've basically pushed through musical boundaries. You've refused to allow any of these conventions like Fender Rhodes to constrain your music making. In 1983, you released an album called Future Shock that featured this crazy crossover Grammy Award winning mega hit song, Rocket. With its equally accoladed music video, did you have any trepidation about making such a diverted groundbreaking record, knowing that, you know, with your jazz pedigree, some of these jazz purists may not embrace what you did?
Well, I had been through that before.
Yeah.
When I did a record called Headhunters.
So, oh, sure.
And I remember that what we call the jazz police.
The jazz police, right.
That, I mean, they completely knocked that record, and the critics downplayed it, and they knocked the record. But it was something that I was determined that I wanted to do. And it was telling me that I'm just doing it because I want to, you know, kowtow to the public's interests, and that I was going to lose my credibility and all that.
And, yeah.
And the thing is, that was not the reason I did Headhunters. I did the Headhunters record, and I did Rocket because I was interested in something in particular that had to do with those records.
Right.
In the case of Headhunters, I had been listening to a lot of Sly Stone's music, plus my background is with R&B.
Right.
I'm from Chicago. It's a blues town.
Right.
Right. And I'm black. Right. So that's part of my heritage.
Right. Sure it is.
And Rocket, I was already into technology. Yeah. I had just heard a record that had scratching on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was Malcolm McLaren's Buffalo Gal.
Right.
And I heard that sound, and it sounded to me like a, like an avant-garde kind of sound.
Right.
That, and yeah. And so I was interested in doing something using turntables. So when that was presented to me by Bill Laswell and Michael Beinhorn, who were like major, like cutting edge record producers that were doing like the newest stuff, right? Right.
Yeah.
And when they presented just some material for me, the first thing they played for me had scratching on it. And I said, that's exactly what I want to do.
Wow.
Anyway, that became Rocket.
Right. I mean,
so it's something I wanted to do. And the heck with what the jazz purists say.
Do you have
it's my record, right?
Yeah,
it's not theirs, you know?
Oh, for sure.
Right.
And I guess in pop culture, though, those that don't know all about everything else that you've done, sometimes do you have any you know, where people, that's the first thing they want to ask you about is the video and the song, because it was such a crossover hit into pop music and it won R&B Grammys and everything else. And of course, if you Google yourself, Rocket's one of the first things that comes up because it won so many right. awards and it was such a groundbreaking record, but it, you know, it is so different from everything else you have done. Has it always been a source of, you were proud that you stuck your neck out and defied the jazz police always?
Always. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I never like to do what I've already done before. I always like to do something that's different.
Well,
you know, otherwise, where's the fun?
Right. Over and over again. So
yeah.
I wanted to ask you about one of the artifacts that we have on display here in the museum in our exhibit. You loaned us a jacket that you wore in the 1986 feature film Round Midnight, where you played keyboardist Eddie Wayne. The soundtrack for the film won both Grammy and an Oscar. That's pretty amazing. Can you talk a little bit about making the film? Because in the jazz world, that's a classic. Not everybody knows that film, but I spoke to the editor of Downbeat Magazine, and he said that film was a classic amongst sort of the jazz world. So what was making that film like, and what does that jacket sort of symbolize for you?
I was thrilled to be asked to do the score for it, and then when Bertrand Tavernier, the director, who, by the way, recently died. Anyway, when he, we had lunch, I think, the day that I met him in New York, and talked about the film. And that's when he asked me to, if I'd be interested in doing the score, and when he told me that they had selected Dexter Gordon to play the lead part,
yeah.
I said, you know, count me in. I'm in. But then, as just before we left, he said, "Well, there's one other thing. I mean, I don't know if you're interested in this or not." And that's when he asked me if I would playing a part in the film as an
right.
actor.
Right. Yeah.
I said I would love to. You know, so that was thrilling. That's something I hadn't done.
Right.
Before.
I mean, you were playing a jazz keyboard player, so it's not like you had to, you know how some people have to fake the piano playing. At least you had the chops. You knew what it was like to maybe not necessarily be a jazz pianist in Paris.
Right. Right.
you at least had a little bit of a step.
Right. And I had been to Paris. I'd been to Paris many times. And I had met Bud Powell, which the film is based off of the lives of two characters, Bud Powell and Lester Young. Kind of combined as one. And, I, you know, I knew that scene. And I understood in the history of jazz about black musicians being expatriates in Europe and because of racism here in America.
Right. You know? Yeah. They found a safe haven, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I was thrilled to be able to do that. And it's one of the highlights of my life.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you stole it from the wardrobe or however you ended up with it. We're thrilled to have it on display here.
Well, I asked and when we finished shooting, I asked if I could keep something. And you're right. I had to go to the wardrobe person and they had to kind of sneak it off the rack.
Well, I'm glad you did. And we're taking very good care of it, and people are really enjoying it.
Thank you. And
we really appreciate you loaning that to us. Well, I was going to ask you about what you did during the pandemic. I know that you're out in Los Angeles. You have your own studio at your house and everything, but what were some of your activities?
Sleeping in my own bed for over a year.
Yeah. No touring.
I hadn't done that since I was in my 20s.
I'll bet.
To sleep in my own bed every night for a year, you know? So that was a thrill.
Yeah.
To be able to be a husband and a father in the house, have dinner with my family whenever I chose, rather than it just being something in my schedule.
Right.
So that was, that part of it's been great. And I had to decide in the beginning, because just like you, many people were asking me, how do I feel that I'm not able to go on tour? I'm not playing for an audience. I'm not able to travel the world and to all these different cities and different languages. And I'm a Buddhist.
Yes.
And Buddhism, one of the main things about the Buddhism I practice, which is Nichiren Buddhism with SGI, is that we try to look to see whatever may be a difficulty or a problem that we're facing, try to look for how we can turn it into something of value.
Mm.
So instead of looking at what I can't do, I said, why don't I look at what I can do?
Oh, what a great perspective.
Oh, yeah. It's the best. That's why I practice it. And it's not just, even though that sounds good, to actually have that like sewn into you, that as a tenet of your belief, so that you approach everything that way. It's life-changing.
Wow.
So it's been really great.
That's amazing. Well, to jump back to technology, the other artifact that you loaned us was a keyboard called a Korg Oasis Workstation. I'm not going to pretend to understand what it is, but I guess I did want to ask you about the way you have always embraced technology, but the pace in which technology changes is pretty breathtaking. How do you go about incorporating new instruments or gadgets or whatever you want to call it into your normal work life, knowing that these things are popping on the market all the time? This particular piece apparently was from around 2007, and now you're not using it anymore. So obviously you've moved on to other things. So how do you go about, addressing the, something new that comes across your life?
Well, for one thing, I had more than one Oasis, but Korg has been making newer instruments since then.
Sure.
And so I upgraded to the Korg Kronos, which is like an advancement past the Oasis. Although there are some technologies within the Oasis that weren't kept. As upgrades were made, and some of them having to do with, and they have to balance how much the instrument costs to make with how much they can sell it for.
Sure, of course.
And so they have to, that's always a balance. And but the advancements of the Kronos are really incredible. That's what I use now is the Kronos. But again, because of the pandemic, I can be in my studio every day.
Sure.
And although that is a analog instrument, now there are so many plug-in instruments that you download off of the internet. I've been able to explore a whole bunch of new plug-in instruments that I plug into my computer, and I'm able to trigger them with instruments like the Oasis or the Kronos,
So the world is your oyster. You just download a sound that you like, a module, and you're off
and running. That has many sounds on it. They have thousands of sounds on them now.
Wow.
Oops, I just dropped something, but it's okay.
So I was going to ask you, so this Oasis keyboard, was this one that you took on the road? Was this one that you had in your studio?
The one
that you loaned us, is this was this a workhorse for you? How would you describe how it helped you?
Oh, yeah. It was the main instrument that I was using at that time.
Well, again,
I took it on the road, yes.
We're very excited to have it on display. Thank you again for loaning it to us. I got really just one kind of open-ended question here. So actually, I was a little intimidated after reading your biography because I'm assuming you're probably the most accomplished person I've ever spoken to. You've won 14 Grammys, Kennedy Center Honors, UNESCO Ambassador of Goodwill, 6 honorary doctorates, video awards, reader polls, all these things. What actually keeps you grounded? How do you get your head through the door? What is it about your daily life that keeps you focused on the tasks at hand? It's just genuinely overwhelming to see all the things that you've done in your career.
Well, I'm 81 years old. I didn't collect them when I was in my 30s. It's taken a while for me to be able to get those different awards and accolades. And actually, I have a few more honorary doctors. I think I have 10 or 11 of them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, I know you got your first one from your alma mater in Iowa. Is it Grinnell?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. What made you, I know we're backtracking a little bit. What made you want to go to a little college in Iowa?
It's interesting that you should ask me this question now, because just maybe a week ago, in the Chicago Sun-Times, there was an article about a lady who was 107 years old named Edith Renfro Smith.
Okay.
She was the first black woman to graduate from Grinnell.
Huh.
And she was born in Grinnell.
Oh.
She lived across the street from me in Chicago when I was a kid. And she was one of my mother's best friends.
And she was your inspiration for going there?
She, when I was graduating from high school, she came over to talk to me and my parents. And she suggested I go to Grinnell. She had gone there. She thought it was a lovely school. The people were nice, yada, yada, yada. And so that piqued because of her, it piqued my interest. But I also knew a student from Hyde Park High School that I went to. Now it's Hyde Park Academy.
Yeah.
And a guy named Donald Stewart. And he was a mid-year student. So he had already been going to Grinnell for a few months at that time. And so I asked him how the school was, and he said it was great, and he recommended it too. So it was Mrs. Smith that started it, and he, you know, put the final lid on the thing, and so that's why I decided to go to Grinnell.
Yeah, plus you knew somebody there then too, wasn't? Was at
yeah,
least, yeah, knew somebody going there,
and I knew somebody there exactly. Then there were a couple other guys that, although it's a small liberal arts college, and at that time they only had at the most 10 black students. You know, and sometimes it was six. You know, but they had, you know, students from all over the United States, and many from Asia and from Europe, from you know, various countries, and it was a thrill to be able to be in that small kind of melting pot.
Yeah,
you know, and to get that kind of experience.
So it was a good nurturing college experience for you.
Absolutely.
Oh.
And I found a drummer from Denmark that played jazz. And that was a trumpet player, John Scott, that actually was one of my roommates for a brief time at Grinnell. And the two of them and I formed a little group, and a bass player, Dave Kelson, also. He was from Iowa. And so we had a little trio, well, a little quartet with these guys.
Did it have a name?
I don't remember. I don't think we had a name. Maybe they may have named it with my name, because I was the one that was.
All right.
I had the most experience.
Sure.
The band, jazz.
The college band leader there. Yeah, absolutely. So I got one last question for you. So what's up next for you now that things? Well, California's a little bit different than some of the other states in the union here. But What's coming up for you? What's next on your horizon?
I've got a tour coming up in September. Oh. And as a matter of fact...
You coming through Illinois?
Yes. I will be playing in Chicago at Symphony Center, which is... Like where I got my, in many ways, where I got my start.
Right. Yeah. Yep. That's full circle for you. Well, if you have an extra bit of time, you are more than welcome to come down to Springfield and see our exhibit. We would love to host you here and give you the grand tour. It's a beautiful presidential library for Lincoln, and this exhibit is here through January 23rd. So we would be... honored to host you here if you found your way to Central Illinois. I know we're still about 3 hours away from Chicago, but
I've been down to Springfield before. I'd be thrilled to be able to do that.
That'd be wonderful.
And thanks for inviting me.
Well, of course, and thank you again for being a part of our podcast. It's been a real pleasure, and all the best to you and your family there in California, and hope to see you soon.
Okay, I hope so too, Lance. Thank you very much.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.